back with episode 688 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and it's sometimes a little strange when an old flame shows up again.
Mm-hmm. And, I really hope that we don't find out in our own lifetimes what it's like to be tortured to be by an AI, but I do know what it's like to be tortured by a network that's keeping an AI from us.
Indeed.
Indeed. Yes, we are going to be getting into the episodic discussion for, I believe, like I said, it was from a couple weeks ago. I'm sorry I don't have the exact date of when that week ended, but it is a week that had quite a few episodes, 20, in fact, that we need to get into. So before, let's just go ahead and do our disclaimer so that we can launch right into it.
Absolutely. If you haven't seen these episodes, we'll spoil you. So fast forward a couple of minutes or so.
Mm-hmm. All right. And yeah, we're going to get into, as usual, the bottom three for the week. And we're probably going to be able to get through these relatively quickly. The first one here is Hunters, Season 1, Episode 2, Messages. Innocent civilians are killed as a result of Hunters bombing random targets on U.S. soil. An investigation is led by Flynn and ETU, revealing that human collaborators are involved in these terrorist acts. But the reason that Flynn's wife was kidnapped still remains a mystery.
Of course, because you've got to have a mystery.
You must. I give this a 7.5 because I'm still waiting for the series to gel. It's coasting along, in my opinion, on interesting visuals, and it's got some great sound design, but that's about it. Mm. It needs to have better characters because I don't care if any of these people die. In fact, I'd probably enjoy watching them do so. With great sound design, though.
Yeah.
Honestly, the sound design actually reminds me quite a lot of The Last of Us, which is a game essentially about a zombie apocalypse. And the big calling card for this show is that it was made by Gail Hurd, who was one of the executive producers for The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, interesting. But really, what I think is the weakness of this show is that it is based, it's an adaptation on a Whitney Scriber property.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, the anti-alien group is a take on CTU that is called ETU.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that
Yeah. It's still not coming together. It's a little too generic. But anyhow. Also coming in our bottom three here is Winona Earp, Season 1, Episode 3, Leavin' on Your Mind. Winona investigates when a posse of revenants go on a killing spree, which she concludes has a darker and more sinister point behind it. Meanwhile, Waverly challenges Henry's motives and sets out to unearth more of his past. This one coming in at an average of 7.25. I think the show is trying.
Tonally, it still seems all over the place to me. The whole thing in this one with this posse and and having these speaking of zombies with the previous show, I mean, yes, it's demons here, but having these fast demons, but where they then give them this this special effect that almost looks like something out of the Benny Hill show. So it's okay, they're scary, but we're supposed to chuckle at the same time. And honestly, I mean, with the family dynamics that were playing out, it still wasn't really grabbing me, and I was quite honestly ready to give up on this based on this episode until our mysterious handsome stranger got revealed as some strange demon version of Doc Holliday himself. So I was that bought them a reprieve to okay, so you finally did the reveal of him. Of Henry, and depending on how they handle that, I might stay or I might go. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll find out soon how that turned out.
Yes,
indeed. All right. Well, let me just real quick something here. Okay, so next on the list, coming in at the bottom of our bottom three, is The Vampire Diaries, Season 7, Episode 18. One way or another, Damon heads to Memphis with Alaric to capture an escaped vampire who may be the key to getting Stefan back safely, but Alaric is reluctant to step back into his former vampire-hunting ways and reveals the truth about the past three Damon-less years of his life. Yeah, this season is kind of limping towards its conclusion, and this one came in at a 7 because, quite frankly, the story is a complete mess. And even the apparent impending doom for Bonnie, which is always welcome turn of events as far as I'm concerned, isn't enough to really raise this above totally average fare. But I will say this, for this week, we have the bottom three still being average or better. And we, in fact, have two shows up in our top three that are at a 9.5. So let's turn to the top three for the week, because that's much better material for discussion, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
And coming in at number three is The 100, Season 3, Episode 11, Nevermore. Allie brings out Raven's dark side. Jasper's anger intensifies, and Octavia struggles with her place in the world. Meanwhile, Monty is forced to make a split-second decision.
Mm.
This one came in at an average of 9, and I just have to say, based on this little recap here, I do want a screen cap of Jasper with underneath of it, anger intensifies. Come on. Anime reference to everyone. Anyway, yes, Bronze Thumb gave us a note here on his score of 9 saying, this feels like a throwback to the first season's vibe in the tight-knit group, but with all the baggage of 2.5 seasons.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's what it felt like. Yes, Edmund, your comments on this one.
Yeah, I mean, this one, I absolutely got that sense as well of even though the group has been so sort of split and riven by all the events that are going on, but that sense of rallying around to try and save Raven from Allie, and the extraordinary lengths that Allie was going to manipulate them and then actually abuse Raven once she realized she wasn't going to get her way. I mean, was just terrifying. As you alluded to at the top, you know, since I haven't been getting my usual AI fix, Allie has been a pretty good substitute in the interim. But
she acts as though she's a good Samaritan.
Yes,
sometimes.
Yes. But she's really, but she's really just Samaritan. Yes.
Yes.
And the machine is the one that's locked away that we're trying to get to. But anyway,
right.
This is also the show. I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily getting back to. I mean, it's something that's there all along. But one of those episodes where there was just some just devastating emotional stuff going on, and that whole sequence with Monty being forced to kill his mother was just horrifying at the end. And then just the little knife turn of, you know, oh no, but you know, there is a way to get the AI out of you. So did I actually have to do that? And just very, very raw and emotional stuff. The way they handle the different factions and things, and but bringing it to that that realistic conclusion of yes, given the circumstances, it is believable that all these people who have been on different sides for certainly most of this season, if not long before that, it does make sense that they would be forced together in these circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And it just it makes narrative sense because they've done a good job of making sure that all these characters' journeys are logically intersecting the way that they are, especially as they are driving here to the end of the season. It's really, I have to say, making the comparison to Game of Thrones, as we have done many times, to say that this is the CW's version of that kind of property, the brutality of what's going on makes perfect sense to me. And it is well earned within the story. And they really push it about as far as you could possibly get. And there are some horrible things that happen to Raven in this episode.
Oh, yes.
And that's just the beginning. I mean, it's the emotional and psychological scars that are being forged here,
mm-hmm.
that are the real bread and butter of this story. And why I really enjoy it, quite honestly. It's just so deep and rich. And you care about the characters because you've known them so long.
Yes, exactly.
So, yes, definitely a worthy addition up here at the top three. Number two is Better Call Saul, Season 2, Episode 10, Click. In the second season finale, Jimmy is forced to make a hard choice, and Mike takes matters into his own hands. Elsewhere, Hamlin relays shocking news while Chuck's condition continues to evolve. And this episode came in at a 9.5. That's amazingly high. And Bronston once again giving his note here with his perfect 10 that he gave the episode. Brutally awesome. Again, Jimmy is at a crossroads between being a better man or going the Saul route, and he's punished for doing the right thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, yes, I gave it a 9. I guess the only thing I might take issue with Bronze Thumb is that whole thing about one reason why I wish he could be here so I could just clarify this, but certainly what Jimmy did was with very good motives, despite the fact that yes, Chuck is being a complete a-hole about it and really pushing it, Chuck also has a bit of a point in terms of the little subterfuge that Jimmy pulled on him to get the bank to drop HHM and give the account back, I kind of felt that this wasn't why I downgraded it. I mean, I thought it was a fabulous episode as well, but that this was just the latest example of Jimmy pushing things just that little bit too far and it having consequences far more far-reaching than he anticipated, and certainly just there was one thing where I had actually forgotten that this season was only going to be 10 episodes, so I wasn't realizing that that previous episode what was the lead-in, having it certainly revolving around Chuck having this hideous injury, and then Jimmy to a large extent kind of being forced back into the caretaker role, or not so much forced, but taking on that caretaker role again. It just made the dynamics just quite extraordinary. To the point where the whole title of the episode, which I've given the spoiler warning, but this is a case of where literally that title was referring to the final act of the season, after all of that, to realize that shady as Jimmy may be, and all those seeds for Saul that are being planted, that it does appear, and we will know next season that it was Chuck being even more underhanded and going through all of this to basically just get Jimmy on tape and click the tape recorder off after Jimmy's left, just to sort of it was just a marvelous way of sort of creating a bit of a cliffhanger, but after you've had this amazingly cathartic showdown between the two of them, and Jimmy finally admitting, but you can't do anything about it, it's just my word against yours, and then just having the evidence that no, unfortunately it's going to be going on a little bit longer than that, this is a case where as much as we were talking earlier in the last episode about shorter episode orders, you can get tighter and that sort of thing, but with the best series there's also that sense of I want a few more episodes, I want to see how it works out from now, so I guess that's just a tribute to wonderful writing and acting.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like, and certainly I hear a lot of great things about this particular show and the last season here, so yeah, definitely seems like it deserved to be up in that lofty top 3, as was our number 1 show. This is a perennial type of thing when it comes to the end of a season, and certainly now that the series is coming towards a close. The Good Wife, Season 7, Episode 19, Landing. Alicia and Luca fly to Toronto to represent an NSA agent who was detained by custom officials or officers when he attempted to re-enter the U.S. And this one came in at 9.5, with Nadim saying, "It is a terrific hour that capably sets the stage for The Good Wife's final 3 hours." That's really all he had to say about it, but that show coming in at number 1. It was basically a tie between number 1 and number 2, with some big name shows really putting their best foot forward. So we are going to move on to the shows that were in the middle of the pack, and again, this week the middle of the pack was anywhere from 7.5 all the way up to 8.8, which is what this show came in at, which is Daredevil Season 2 Episode 5, Kinbaku. A former lover arrives in Hell's Kitchen and turns Murdoch's world upside down. Karen digs for the truth about the Punisher. And this one coming in, as I said, at an 8.8, with Bronze Thumbs giving it a 9, saying, "Elektra is the Hannibal to Matt's Will Graham, seducing him into embracing his id, no matter the consequences or collateral damage. It's fascinating and brilliant." Yes, Elektra certainly does seem to have a very familiar personality. Let's put it that way. Perhaps a little devoted in wanting to drive her love interest towards more and more murderous ways. Just saying, it felt very familiar. But anyway, I kind of dug her. Yes. I kind of like this version of Elektra. She's exactly as crazy and morally ambiguous and questionable as the character was back when she was in the heyday of the Frank Miller days.
Yeah, no, certainly. I know that you and Gary who are the big comics people, but I haven't mentioned it much because I wasn't a devoted constant reader, those runs of Daredevil were ones that I did check in on fairly regularly. So I mean, one of the things I have really enjoyed about this series is how much they are sticking to that template. And this was certainly, I mean, just a wonderful expansion of the whole Matt Murdock persona and that crazy side of it, as opposed to some other shows like Arrow that haven't been making good use of flashbacks in the past season or so. This was certainly a case of finding out some of the roots of where their relationship took them in the past was just a marvelous look into what she's trying to push him to now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I'm intrigued by her reasoning and what exactly it is that she's got going on behind that smile of hers. She's definitely gives the impression of someone who's a bit unhinged, but there's got to be a method to the madness. There always is. So I'm curious as to what it's going to turn out to be. And I'm sure that it is exactly as complicated as Matt thinks it is. Because yes. He knows he's in trouble. Because she's back in his life. So let's see. Sorry, I've just got a bit of technical difficulty to try and resolve. Okay. For now, that's going to work. All right. So next on the list, we have Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 3, Episode 17, The Team. Daisy calls upon the Secret Warriors for a dangerous inaugural mission, and S.H.I.E.L.D. learns more about Hive's powers, making them question everyone they trust.
Ooh, yeah.
And this coming in just a hair under Daredevil with an average of 8.75. And Bronze Thumb gave this one an 8, saying, badass with a great conflict, but we needed more of the Secret Warriors in action, and it was painfully obvious who the traitor was. Mm. I don't know if it was quite that obvious, but I do agree with the fact that while I gave this one a 9 personally, I do agree that maybe giving the Secret Warriors a little bit more time on screen before everything fell apart would have been a good idea.
Yeah, I can see that. At the same time, I mean, I thought they basically made the fact that they were certainly half of the team was rather green and inexperienced. I thought they did a good job of working that into the story and the suspicions. And even the way the two newer members sort of then started taking solidarity with each other and against these S.H.I.E.L.D. folks who are treating us badly. I think it actually did a good job of sort of playing on those inexperiences rather than if they'd been together for a few episodes or even a couple of episodes and doing some missions together, there would have been more sort of team solidarity. It helped explain the fractures better.
Yeah, I do have to say that I really enjoyed the way that the episode ended. I liked the way that the played out in terms of who it was and then how things happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of brutal in many ways. And I also really like the fact that they are once again proving that first season that so many people kind of dismissed actually means something, because if you didn't know what their history was,
yes,
this wouldn't be nearly so meaningful. So... yes, that is sometimes you've got to start a little slow in order to make things matter later down the road. Speaking of, this season of The Americans would be a good example of that.
Yes.
Season 4, Episode 5, Clark's Place. Philip faces a tough choice that will drastically impact him and Martha.
Oh,
this
yeah.
episode coming in at an average of 8.5. And a little bit of a transitional episode,
yeah,
but it points directly to some major consequences to come.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, certainly, I mean, we've had Nina meet her fate, and Martha is another character who has managed to stick around far longer than some fans of the show ever expected. And in fact, it's rather intriguing in terms of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Both her and Nina were intended to be far earlier casualties until the producers recognized what acting gold they had they had in their hands, and managed to figure out how to get them to stick around longer. But we certainly do seem to be this seems to be the start of Martha's endgame. This is a case of really I gave it an 8.5 more just because the plot itself was more setting up the suspicion, setting up having to get Martha to the safe house. Very much a transitional episode, but within that, I mean, the acting and the performances from all parties. I mean, certainly Philip and Elizabeth, Gabriel and Martha on one side, but then the FBI agents as well. Certainly, with Stan and Gad and the new guy whose name I always fumble, Amandor, I believe. No, that was the original one. Anyway. As certainly on the FBI side, as they're coming to the realizations of just what's going on here, and the implications are dawning on them, and then at the same time, for the KGB side of things, the dynamics within the group in terms of Gabriel and Elizabeth realizing just how important this is to Philip, and that this isn't just cut and dried business as usual, try and get someone out of the country, and if you can't, take the necessary action. Some marvelously tense stuff, for a relatively quiet episode that's about a pretty literal cat and mouse game, or the start of a cat and mouse game, having Martha just walk out of the house, because now she's there with Gabriel, who of course really can't do anything about it, given his physical condition, etc. Yes, she really can just walk away, leave us in pretty extreme suspense about what the heck that's going to lead to in the next episode, which we will actually get to discuss next episode.
That's right. All right, and let's see here. That means we are going to move on to Vikings, Season 4, Episode 9, Death All Round. Yay! As they near Paris, the Vikings relaunch their boats, but this time they bear interesting structures made by Floki. Æthelwulf and Alfred arrive in Rome, where honors are bestowed by Pope Leo, but in Wessex, relations are less than cordial between King Ecgbert and a disgruntled King Æil. All right, and this one came in at an average of 8.5. It's basically just some really solid setup for what's going to happen in the mid-season finale. And, just a really good character-driven setup episode. Can't complain. All right, next we have The Flash, Season 2, Episode 18, Versus Zoom. Equipped with the tachyon device, Barry believes he is fast enough to stop Zoom and wants to open the breaches to catch him. Harry strongly advises against that plan. But after Barry convinces him, Harry reveals that Sisko has the power to reopen the breach. Meanwhile, Hunter Zolomon's painful story on Earth 2 is revealed. Yes, this was the kind of backstory for Zoom, and this one came in at an average of 8.5, largely on Gary's 9.5 score, which was much higher than the two of us. Quite frankly, I wish that he was here, because this didn't really quite gel for me. Maybe just Zoom's backstory didn't quite add up, I don't know, but... yeah, just something about this episode didn't quite catch for me.
I gave it an 8 as well. So I mean, I did think it was quite good. I would imagine that we hopefully will get his take on it, his more specific take on it at some point. But certainly in terms of giving this much this much backstory to one of the pretty iconic members of the Flash family, I would imagine it was the DC fanboy in Gary that was kind of geeking out over all that. For me. I think they've done a decent job in terms of the sort of Earth Prime versus Earth 2 characters. The whole thing of Sisko trying to embrace sort of the full nature of his powers, it's just the way those elements are playing out after that first introduction of Earth 2, where I was really feeling like, you know, oh no, you know, we do have a series that sort of is picking up that Fringe mantle, that you know, yes, even though I know it's the Flash, it's more comic booky and not as emotionally serious and without as much depth as Fringe, but it was giving me some of those feelings and comparisons earlier on, but now the way things are playing out, it's just a different place that they go. I'm kind of not getting those fun mythic resonances that I was from Fringe.
Okay, let's see. Next, we have The Return of Orphan Black, Season 4, Episode 1, The Collapse of Nature. In the fourth season premiere, a Neolution attack destroys Sarah's refuge in Iceland and forces her to flee once again. Really? Is that what the episode was about?
Yeah, well, right at the end.
Yes, the last, like, 30 seconds. This episode, by the way, coming in at an average of 8.17.
Yes. Also, and, also, are we just skipping over the other DC show?
I actually, unfortunately, clicked the wrong thing, so we'll do that next. Don't worry. Okay. I noticed that myself and just was going to keep going, but all right, fine.
Okay.
Bronstone puts it pretty well, saying that Orphan Black feels like a soft reset, getting back to the season one conflicts and doing so by putting Beth front and center for the first time. It's a great idea and well executed. I actually agree. This was 99% flashback.
Yes.
And it worked really well by adding some layers to the mythology. I'm still a bit confused.
Which I think was partially intentional.
Yes, they are referring to a bunch of things that are hard to remember because it was three very long, convoluted seasons ago. But the fact of the matter is that it actually somewhat simplifies matters, plot-wise.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, after I'm one of those who certainly had been having some major reservations with the way they just seem to be introducing machinations within machinations, and certainly with Dyad initially becoming part of an even bigger plot, and then the caster clones coming in, however you want to term it. I mean, soft reboot or going back to their roots, but certainly the fact that they were focusing so much on the original Clone Club, but in fact giving Tatiana just a little bit more to do, so she gets to more fully flesh out the Beth character, who of course we didn't ever really meet. It was just Sarah's version of her that we were seeing primarily, except that I think there was the very occasional flashback back in season one, so that was always fun. Plus, of course, a new hacker version, they are keeping up with the quota of Tatiana has to create at least two or three more versions of herself for every season, for me getting back to that that original focus and original group was just a major plus. Although I had to go back and sort of rewatch that ending a couple of times, because it really took me a while to realize that, because just in terms of some of the dynamics, until I realized, okay, I think he's playing it cool because of who's in front of him. But I think that was deliberate in the storytelling, where you really weren't sure. It's like, you know, well, wait a minute, when is the new hacker warning about this? And then and then we're just supposed to realize, like, oh no, we've jumped forward into the present now.
right, exactly. They do try to play a little bit of a game there at the end, and that probably added to my confusion. But most of the episode played out like a prequel, and that actually worked out pretty well.
Yes.
That whether or not they stick with that, we'll have to see. The episode I skipped over, unfortunately, which got around the same score at an 8.2, was Supergirl, Season 1, Episode 20, Better Angels. Supergirl's enemies plot to destroy every person on the planet, and stopping them won't be easy for the Woman of Steel. In the season one finale. Yes, quite a lot of scores for this one. Nadine gave this one a 9.5, saying a perfect season finale in every way. Fingers crossed we get a season two, because Supergirl certainly deserves it. Bronstum, not nearly as pleased, giving it a 7, saying a perfunctory battle and what felt like a lot of hand-wringing, dragged-down, good character stuff. The two of them need to get in a room and really work this out.
Yes.
Just saying.
Kind of like Kara and Alex.
That's right. I felt like that particular battle actually was over a little too quickly. It seemed to be like first act and done.
Yeah.
But really, that said, looking back on how the pacing of the episode went, they've really spent exactly as much time as they needed to with each of the showdowns and the kind of consequential discussions that had to happen. I thought the pacing was really good for this episode.
Yeah, I would agree. And also, I mean, for me, it was just it's one of these shows where it's kind of part of the ethos that Alex could get turned, but the emphasis on connection and family and how much they've made of that, it would make sense that she was able to beat back something that is a Kryptonian in nature, so she kind of knows what buttons to hit, and it's not like the technology is so all powerful that decades of history can't be deployed against it. So given the show this is, that did make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, let's see here. Okay. Now getting back on track, perhaps, we have Grimm, Season 5, Episode 17, Inugami. Local youths are in danger due to an ancient code of vengeance that has been adopted by Japanese Vezin, and Adeline crosses paths with Eve upon returning to work at her old law firm. And I see the use of the words Japanese Vezin and think to myself, oh, so it's like Attack on Titan, where everything takes place in Germany, but they're all it's a Japanese story. sure. This one came in at an 8. And I really liked the idea of bringing in these other cultural ideas rather than the kind of northern, northwestern European basis that we have here with the series. And I do like the idea that I know that Gary disagreed with it to a certain extent, but I felt that they established the whole Nick Adeland relationship well enough that right now the fact that they are clearly headed for a fall is actually kind of poignant. It's kind of unfortunate because you really got to invest in the idea that the two of these two former enemies might actually be able to work things out. And it looks like that may not be for a very long time. So, oh well, it happens. Next on the list is the original Season 3, Episode 18, The Devil Comes Here and Sighs. As the city celebrates its annual jazz fest, an unlikely team of Michelson foes joins the forces to take Klaus hostage. And this one also came in at an 8. Lots of torture in this episode, but I really don't know how they expect to resolve this whole idea of the uber original that they've created at this rate. They only have 4 episodes left for the season. They're going to have to do some overtime plotting this one out to make it seem viable, in my opinion. All right, and next we have Elementary, Season 4, Episode 21, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. Holmes and Watson investigate a double homicide and discover the victims were staging a fake murder at the moment they were killed. Meanwhile, Joan's inside man at Moreland's office encounters a problem that threatens to expose her spying to Holmes and his father. And Edmund, you can comment on this one.
Yes, I gave this an 8. This was an improvement over the recent trend of Elementary. As ever, it's still the two different halves of the show each time. But this was a reasonably twisty case with some intriguing things that they did actually have to figure out. Not just tracking down the evidence and coming up with the relatively pedestrian solution to things. There were some nice twists and turns, what was really they make a bigger thing of it in the recap, but really then this kind of twist ending to everything of where the spy that Joan had tapped in Moreland's office shows up dead at the very end. Some of my reservations about how they were using Moreland Holmes, it does appear that, yes, they may be making him a little more shifty and nefarious, just like I wanted him to be. So, once again, we will have to see how they resolve that, perhaps next episode.
Perhaps. All right, we have another season premiere here, 12 Monkeys, Season 2, Episode 1, Year of the Monkey. Cole and Ramsey mend their broken friendship while on the run from the army of the 12 Monkeys in the Season 2 premiere. In the year 2043, Rayleigh and Jones navigate an uncertain future as Deacon and the 12 command the temporal facility. That means an awful lot to people who watch the show. And it's really confusing to everybody else.
Yes.
No, wait. It's still really confusing to people who watch the show, but we love it, being confused by these writers. It's a really good show. It's super dense as in terms of the premiere. There's a lot that you need to kind of remember and keep in mind as you go. This is the kind of show that you usually have to watch twice just to make sure that you know what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the fact they're shaking things up.
Yeah.
And this begins a process of kind of reframing the show, mm-hmm. from what I can tell.
Yeah. I mean, quite stunned by this premiere. I actually was pleasantly surprised by how much I was able to follow, even the first time around. I actually had been thinking of trying to go back to rewatch a couple of the last episodes of last season, but I hadn't had a chance to. But in the end, didn't need to. But the whole situation they set up of basically the fact that they managed to get down to a situation where Cole and Cassie basically had a gun on Cole, and they made it believable was really quite extraordinary. This whole thing they're still trying to track down exactly what the 12 monkeys are up to. But the conflicts they set up, both in terms of the problems in the present day, combined with some pretty major stuff going on back in 2043. It was just very nicely done. And certainly, in terms of the way the time stream seemed to be shifting, and even people's characters sort of shifting and transmuting, was quite remarkable to see. And looking forward to seeing how they keep going with that.
Absolutely. All right, next on the list we have Fear the Walking Dead, Season 2, Episode 2, We All Fall Down. The group seeks shelter with a survivalist family, and Madison tries to uncover the family's true motives. Meanwhile, Salazar works to discover Strand's intentions. And this came in at an average of 7.63. And over at VogNetwork.com, we had some comments from a couple different people. S. Elliot Fisher, our often commenter over on the forums, gave this one an 8.5, saying, "A good episode as the group moves further away from the old world and closer to the new one. Nick continues to suffer from credibility issues with his family as he struggles with his addiction. Nick always seems to be more aware when something is off when the others are slower to notice. The info dump was handled well with the casual conversation between Travis and George. Victor's appearance, though limited, hints to the illusion that there's more to him and what he knew about the outbreak." Meanwhile, Flacco Jones didn't like this much at all. He gave this a 6.5, saying, "I agree with your overall opinion, but felt it deserved a harsher grade. I didn't like the island's family subplot at all. So removing that from the equation, as it pretty much canceled itself out at the end, means even less of the episode did anything to move the story forward. With the West Coast torched and the boat on its way to Mexico, I don't see the show being able to do anything different than the main series. Also feels like Strand isn't going to be around much longer, which is a shame." Mm-hmm. So two very different opinions here from our friends over at VogNetwork.com. Bronstums gave this an 8, saying, "A well-acted, naturalistic little morality tale that reinforces why I like the show. It can tell stories that The Walking Dead has moved on from." I guess that's one way of looking at it. I gave it kind of a 7.5, a little bit above average. There were some things I liked about it, but I kind of strayed more from towards what Flacco was saying. How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, my issue was more the fact that it's stories that The Walking Dead has moved on from, but it was feeling like very similar to early stories from The Walking Dead. Our group on its own, they're moving through water rather than across land, and then happening upon people and bad things happening. And also, as Flacco said, I mean, the fact that, yes, we come across his family, and then basically the story is basically dispensed with in the course of the episode, means that, so they wind up just back on the boat continuing down the coast. I think the main thing is just that things are not moving fast enough. The way they're stringing out, you know, if anything, I mean, no, the circumstance may have been similar to early seasons of The Walking Dead, but the way they're sort of stringing along the mystery of Strand and what he does or doesn't know and where they're actually going feels more like some of the stretching and padding they've done in later seasons.
Hmm. In its own way, it does, and yet what people, you know, the comparison to the early part of The Walking Dead is a good one, because what I recall are a lot of people complaining about the fact that the first two seasons of The Walking Dead, action was far and few between, and there were just these kind of semi-repetitive things happening again and again, especially at the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Are we going to have people yelling at Nick to stay at the house?
Stay on the boat! Stay on the boat!
Or will it be Chris? Let's find out. Anyway, moving on then to the next show on the list, we have the series finale for Bitten, Season 3, Episode 10, Truth Changes Everything. As do, apparently, unnecessary commas. Everything forever could change if Elena's bold and dangerous plan to bring back Stonehaven and save what remains of the pack is successful in the series finale. This one, I gave a 7.5. It was decent enough for a series finale, but the third season overall just felt really thin on story, and it really just felt like they didn't have any money to do anything with. So they kind of did what they could with what they had, and that's what we've got. And so it's unfortunate. They really should have probably not even tried to have the third season if this is what they were able to do with what little they had. And finally, we have Legends of Tomorrow, Season 1, Episode 11, The Magnificent Eight. When the team needs a place to hide out, Rip sets a course for the Old West. Upon arrival, they start a fight with a gang of outlaws that puts a small town in jeopardy. Luckily, Rip's old friend Jonah Hex steps in to save them. And this episode came in at a 7.5. Bronze Thumb says, a lot of fun playing with the Western stuff, and I like Jonah Hex, but the new Time Master villains were such an epic letdown that it taints everything else. And I don't know, I kind of enjoyed the cheesiness in this episode. It kind of elevated the material, in my opinion. I think you fell between the two of us there, Edmund.
Yeah, I quite liked Jonah Hex. I thought they did it reasonably well, but it still felt like a bit of a filler episode. Certainly, just sort of passing the time before they can get on to more important things in the story. Since naturally, the idea of them hiding out in another time era wasn't something you really thought was going to work out anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. This show has got some interesting aspects to it. I still think they're trying to find their identity. This kind of semi-anthology thing that they're doing here does help at times. But
yeah,
I don't know.
I think at this point, I mean, now that we've had on this particular, you know, when you've got things like 12 Monkeys coming back and kind of reminding us of, you know, yes, all of the really fun things you can do with time travel, it's not reflecting well on Legends of Tomorrow for me anyway.
I think that's a fairly good observation.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, and Orphan Black, for that matter, since they've decided to start they're not going back and forth in time, but they are narratively. So.
True enough. True enough. But no, I think that's a really good point. Is that on the other hand, I will say I mentioned the cheese factor, and I think that has something to do with it. I think that they are intentionally going for a bit of a over the top silliness, and maybe doubling down on what the Flash added that Arrow lacked.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that has kind of left us feeling a little bit like, yeah, that you've got all these characters and they get to play in the sandbox and we get to do all these new things and go and revisit certain time periods and do and see characters in different circumstances, and that's all well and good. We get to see characters that we never would see get their own series, like Jonah Hex, and everyone knows, just in this one little episodic moment, it outshines everything that was done in the movie version. So there's that too. But at the same time, it's like I still don't have the feeling that this show is gelling.
Mm-hmm.
And episodes like this are fun, and I gave this an 8. It was an enjoyable episode, but I'm starting to feel like I just have to take it episode by episode, and I'm never really going to be sure what I'm going to get next.
Yeah,
if it's going to be great or if it's going to be just a blah letdown.
Yeah, and I'd say letdown is what had just popped into my head, but it was more because of the contrast between having that those recent episodes where they did get where they were getting stranded in the 50s for a couple of years and having to actually live through those years and and then have all the consequences crop up from that. It's like one moment they're taking a more interesting, more serious turn with it, and then it's sort of whiplash to go back to, and now we're just gonna have a fun little Western episode.
Yeah. Well, as I said, that actually brings the episodic discussion for the week ending April 19th to a close, and that means that we can kind of move on to some of the early discussion for the week ending the 26th of April, at least get into the bottom three for that week. So let's go ahead and shift gears back to that. And yes, this week, the week ending the 26th of April, for those who are keeping score here, the scores went from anywhere as high as a 9 down to as low as a 6.5. So certainly we have a bit of a stretch here in terms of the amount of material. But I will say that the majority of the material is an 8 or above, which is quite impressive. So we're going to go ahead and start with the first of the bottom three episodes for this week, and that is Elementary, Season 4, Episode 22, Turn It Upside Down. Holmes suspects his father of murder after one of his dad's employees is killed under the guise of a robbery. And this came in at a 7.5. Edmund, your comments on this one?
Yeah, so this was, as I mentioned earlier in this episode, this was basically continuing right on from the end of the previous episode where Joan's spy in Moreland's office was discovered killed. And it's basically them moving through the investigation of that. Lo and behold, while it was decently enough done, my disappointment was more in the fact that no, of course, it wasn't Moreland who was being nefarious and devising intriguing ways of getting his employee killed. It was in fact the people he was spying on or spying for to pass Moreland's information on to. So my continuing frustration that this series that I feel really does need to reintroduce a big bad still refuses to do so. And that's only partially because I know how good John Noble would be being really nasty and sinister if they let him. he's doing a very good job of implying it and making people think that he might be nasty and sinister, before they pull back on it a little bit each time. But I'd really love to see them let him loose.
Mm-hmm. All right, next on our bottom three, coming in at an average of 7, so average is the word to use here, The Vampire Diaries, Season 7, Episode 19, Somebody That I Used to Know. Enzo's efforts to protect Bonnie put her life in jeopardy, and it's learned that Reyna may hold the key to Bonnie's survival. I would hope that the survival doesn't happen, actually, because I don't like the character at all. I can't wait for her to leave, so an episode devoted a lot to Bonnie was probably not going to be up my alley, and sure enough, it kind of fell flat for me. So once again, a 7 for The Vampire Diaries. And that means that our lowest scored episode for the week is coming in at 6.5, Winona Earp, Season 1, Episode 4, The Blade. Winona and Dolls have to act quickly to stop Purgatory residents from being attacked by a seemingly invisible assailant. And yeah, like I said, this one came in at a rousing 6.5, so a below average score. I gotta say, Edmund, this is not unlike my comments a little bit earlier about Legends of Tomorrow. This show, I can't tell if they're serious or not.
Yes.
I really feel like they're either trying to be serious and failing desperately at it, or they're trying to be satirical and funny and they're just underselling it.
It's too blah, yeah.
Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Yeah,
on this?
I mean, this one was where, as I mentioned about the previous episode. I mean, I was ready to give up on the series at the end of that episode, and then it was the whole Doc Holliday reveal. And this episode, I did feel like they were trying to show us what the sort of dynamics of this team are going to be, but it's just still not grabbing me. Especially as the sort of bones of the team are coming, are sort of settling falling into place. It just feels so much like a Lost Girl wannabe, you know, to the point where it's, you know, yeah, Winona and Dolls are Bo and Kenzie. Henry is the Dyson, you know, clone. Our deputy marshal is, you know, is our Hale, you know, and he's even in law enforcement and happens to be the same color. And of course, you know, they did actually, you know, they did kill him off, but we even had an older gray haired bartender slash mentor earlier in the season. And it just at this point, I mean, I am, you know, and the whole setup of, you know, yes, all these demons trapped in this, you know, sort of Death Valley triangle. It is just not grabbing me at all. So, I mean, I think it's time for me to drop out and maybe find out from you if you stick with it, or just from reviews down the road, whether it improves. But at this point, I'm not finding it worth my time.
It really, I don't know if I'm going to wind up giving it a little bit of a more time or not. We'll see how it goes. But at least for now, what this really feels like, I think you even mentioned it, is all of the problems with Lost Girl kind of slumped on top of a low budget ripoff of Supernatural.
Yeah. Oh God. Well. Yeah. Well. I mean, certainly the whole mirror in the you know, in the demon circle was looking very familiar there.
Yeah. Just a little. All right. What we're going to go ahead and do is kind of end up here. When we come back for our next episode, we're going to get into the top three and then the rest of the episodic discussion for the week ending the 26th of April. And yeah, if we have a little bit of time after that, we'll see how it goes. But considering that we have a certain season premiere to cover, I think we're going to still be pretty full up on episodic discussion next time. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.